I'm going to call this meeting of the House Committee on Early Childhood and Family Supports for Tuesday, February 21st, to order. So we have a quorum, so we'll be first. We have several other things I want to talk about, but we'll first move into the informational portion of the meeting. And then when, as I know, Representative Huffman and Representative Peluso are testifying on bills, and as soon as they're done, they will be here. But let's open the informational meeting. So we have Lindsay Capps, Brett Walker. So I don't know, there's five people. I guess we can't all get to the voting at the same time.
You can call up the first three. And then.
So I have Lindsay, Brett, and is it Cara or Kara?
Kara.
Thank you for being here. And if you just introduce yourself for the record, we don't know who you are, so.
It's fair.
It's fair, huh?
Chair Lively, members of the committee, for the record, Lindsay Capps, Chief Education Officer. Did you want us to go through and introduce the three of us, or just do that as we go?
Just do that as you go. Thank you.
So I'm excited to be here today to present with my fellow panelists. One of the statutory responsibilities that was given to the Chief Education Office was to work on coordinating and convening with our state agencies and across sectors to ensure that not only our early learning system is connected with our K-12 system, but our K-12 system is connected to higher ed. So we're coming here today for the purposes of talking a little bit about the work that we are doing in tandem with the Early Learning Division and the Oregon Department of Education to better align these systems in standards, in practices, and most importantly, in outcomes. Part of this work, as we'll talk about today, is how we more effectively smooth these transitions for our children and families from birth to third grade. And we're going to be sharing some information about our ongoing efforts to connect early learning in K-12, efforts that we oftentimes refer to as the P3, or the pre-kindergarten to third grade transition, or sometimes the prenatal to third grade transition, to ensure that our children are ready for kindergarten, that their learning experiences are developmentally appropriate and culturally responsive. And that families and caregivers have tools and resources they need to support children's learning and development at home. From a system perspective, these efforts are also critically important to ensuring that income, race, and disabilities-based disparities are eliminated by third grade, which is a critical benchmark in terms of ensuring the success of our students across the learning continuum on to high school graduation and beyond. And it's built within, I think, the broader and very important work in which I know this committee is engaged in terms of linking health services and family supports to ensure fewer children start school with preventative health, developmental, and social emotional delays. As I think you'll hear from this discussion today, this P3 alignment work is multifaceted. It involves really strengthening the professional practice of educators and the sometimes very difficult task of creating seamless approaches to curriculum, instruction, classroom environment, and assessment. It involves building partnerships between schools and the community so that schools can know who children are when they enter kindergarten and what types of early learning experiences they've had. And importantly, it involves engaging as equal partners and understanding the cultural context in which children in the community are being raised. And I think you all are aware of the demographic shifts that we are undergoing as a state and the rich cultural diversity that is part of our early learning system and increasingly our K-12 system. So this work is critically important. I also want to call out the value of P3 transition work both at the local and state levels. At the state level, our P3 work is really about fostering a strong, collaborative working relationship across our education agencies and producing resources, tools, and supports for early learning providers in K-3 or kindergarten through third grade educators. Kara will speak to some of the efforts in just a moment. Now, at the local level, we are seeing a multitude of very promising and innovative P3 strategies and approaches taking shape throughout the state, some of which you'll have a chance to hear about today. Just in closing, I would note that while programs and initiatives will evolve over time, we see the P3 alignment as a critical long-term investment in achieving our goals of ensuring that every child in Oregon receives a top-notch education and graduates from our schools, college, and career ready. And we know that this will pay dividends from a cost-saving standpoint and a return on investment standpoint for our system, that the more we do work effectively in the early learning space and in those transitions from pre-K into the K-12 system, we will reduce the costs of remediation, and we will certainly put students on a path to achieving the outcomes that they should be meeting as they move across the learning continuum. So I would just thank the committee for your time and focus today on this important work, and happy to take any questions.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Lively and representatives on the panel. My name is Kara Williams, and I am the pre-K to third grade coordinator at the Department of Education. My job today is going to be to provide, My job will be to provide a little more information about what pre-K means and kind of the big picture of pre-kindergarten to third grade alignment in Oregon. Starting out with this slide, just to kind of show that pre-K to third grade alignment consists of what we call the eight buckets of work. So when we're talking about alignment, we're not just talking about aligning one or two systems, but rather we're talking about aligning all of our systems, programs, services, how our staff operate and function, how families engage with our schools. And so the eight buckets of work are typically described as being that cross-sector work, so meaning that we want to make sure that we're not only aligning within our schools or among the grades, but that we're also including our community partners that help us to best serve children and families. We talk about administrator effectiveness. So we're talking about how can administrators get that pre-K to third grade lens, that wide-angled lens to really see how children are transitioning from grade to grade. We talk about the teachers, of course, teacher effectiveness in the classrooms. The instructional tools that are used, are those aligned? Those make sense. Are we scaffolding and building from one year to the next? We talk about the learning environments that children are in. Again, so as children transition from grade to grade or from program into K-12, does it make sense? Do their environments make sense? Are they developmentally appropriate for the children? Are they receiving them and transitioning them well? We talk about data-driven improvement. So again, I think we all can agree that looking at the data, looking at the results of the assessment, looking at what the numbers tell us is very important, but it's not only important within a program, but amongst programs, looking at it collectively and seeing what kind of story it tells. We talk about family engagement. So we know that if we don't get families in at the very earliest opportunity, that every year we don't have them engaged, it becomes more and more difficult to engage them. So we're really talking about what are our strategies year after year to assure that we're continuing to bring families in and to engage them in the process and their child's education. And then we talk about continuity and pathways. And so again, that's continuity amongst our programs and then pathways from one program to the next. So again, that we're making those warm handoffs, providing those transitions, not only for students, but also for those families that we just talked about. So this next slide is just to kind of give you a look at what pre-K to third grade means when we talk about that. And so in pre-K, we're talking about the fact that pre-K, if we can get children in high-quality programs, we can close that achievement gap and help them be ready to school. Children are then received into a full day of kindergarten program, which we're proud to now have in Oregon, where it serves as a transition year. So it's kind of the springboard for the rest of their journey in school. And then grades 1 through 3, that high-quality early learning builds strong foundations for lifelong learning. So we're continuing to build. Sometimes when people talk about pre-K to third grade alignment, we kind of miss the first through third grade piece of it, which is equally as important. So this means that we're having a quality kindergarten, quality pre-K program that folds into a quality full-day kindergarten program that folds into quality first grade, quality second grade, and quality third grade. And of course, then we want to see that continue all the way through their academic career. It certainly doesn't stop it at third grade. So some of the things that are happening in pre-K and kindergarten, some things that we'll talk about today here in Oregon, are just a few of the great things that are happening. So this is by no means meant to be an exhaustive list of all of the great things that are happening in Oregon, but yet to give you a taste of the kinds of things that are happening here and some things that we may want to build on. Of course, we know that we have full-day kindergarten. We have shared professional development opportunities, and we'll talk about all these things in a minute. We have now aligned learning standards, which I'm going to be really excited to present to you. Kindergarten transition practices, school district-run preschools and early learning partnerships, and the Kindergarten Partnership and Innovation Grant. So some examples of professional development opportunities, and this is just a really short list, but just to give you kind of a taste for what's happening in Oregon, we have an annual early learning conference where we have kindergarten teachers and pre-kindergarten teachers and child care providers and even first and second grade teachers coming and administrators coming together and learning together and attending training together. That we had our first one this year, and it was a great success, and it was really exciting to see these various audiences who had in the past attended separate conferences and got their learning and professional development separately. Now they're coming together and they're receiving the same information. We have coming up regional spring seminars where some of us will be on the road going out around Oregon and presenting information again for that mixed audience. And we're talking child care providers will be at the table, teachers, administrators, kindergarten, first, second grade, which is really exciting. And then we also have something happening that's happened for a few years now and is really starting to get some momentum, which is the Summer Institute, where, again, we have a week-long format where we have early learning providers and K-3 administrators and teachers that can come together and actually have a week-long intensive opportunity for intensive training on such things as cultivating social-emotional skills in the classroom, trauma-informed care, the early learning guidelines, learning standards, how to implement a quality full-day kindergarten program, those kinds of things. So I always like sharing this information just to give a taste of what has happened in Oregon so quickly. So before we had funding for full-day kindergarten in 2015-2016, we had a little more than 40% of kindergartens in Oregon that were offered for a full day. In 2015-2016, of course, We had state funding available, and most districts, in fact, over 99% now of children are in a full-day program. But you can see with all of that growth comes a lot of need for professional development. And so those professional development opportunities that I showed you in the slide before really are partially in a reaction to this need and thirst from administrators and teachers to get more information about how do we run a full-day kindergarten classroom, which is actually very different than the half day that many districts were providing before. So we're really working on that piece and really working on the fact that now we are positioned to be able to provide a kindergarten experience that is more appropriate to the development of the young students coming into our classrooms because we have that full day. We can slow things down a little bit. We can have more take more of a holistic look to education, provide some more provide education in some other subject areas that we may not have been able to before. So that's been a huge benefit. But also there's been a huge need for professional development and supports. The last thing that I will talk to you about today is a very exciting thing that we have just recently released, which is Oregon's Early Learning and Kindergarten Guidelines. This was actually the result of over a year and a half of work with an extensive work group of folks from the field, kindergarten teachers, child care providers, Head Start directors. We had administrators, university researchers that came together and worked on this document for over a year and a half, bringing together Oregon's early learning standards for children ages 3 to 5 with the learning standards for kindergarten, and really enjoining them and kind of showing how there's a continuum of learning for those students. One of the really exciting products of that work were new standards in the areas of social emotional learning and approaches to learning for kindergarten. So now we have, when you look at this document, we have a very nice layout where parents, teachers, administrators can look at a child's development all the way from age 3 through the end of kindergarten on one continuum. So we can really see that alignment, what we're trying to build on, and it provides teachers with an idea of really what we're aiming for. Whereas I think in the past we've been prone to looking at things in a siloed, you know, I teach 3-year-olds, so I will look at the 3-year-old standards. We're now really realizing, and educators are really hungry for this, the need to understand both where children are and where they're going, and also where they've been. So this is a really exciting thing. It's new on ODE's website. We're working now on launching this statewide, and those spring seminars that I talked about earlier, this is going to be a big topic at that spring seminar, and we're actually able to roll these out and provide some resources for folks. So with that, I am actually going to pass the baton to Superintendent Mary Alice Russell. She's superintendent of the McMinnville School District, and Mary Alice has agreed and come and talk to us about some of the really exciting work that McMinnville has done as far as pre-K to third grade alignment.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, and I think I'll be switching out with those behind me, but if you have questions at any time, don't hesitate to ask. And I'll just share a couple of things with you about McMinnville Schools. And first of all, let me start by saying we had a lot of concerns within the district about the needs our children had coming into kindergarten. Many of them were not ready for school.
And just for the purpose of the record, if you would introduce yourself.
Oh, I'm Mary Alice Russell, Superintendent of McMinnville School
Thank
District.
You.
So back to some of our concerns. We had children that were coming to kindergarten ill-prepared to be successful in grade K, and like the research literature states here, they were already behind their peers. We're a poverty district. We're about 63% poverty in total, and our highest poverty school is about 85% poverty. And children were just not being successful from the day they came to school, and as far as we're concerned, that's just not right. It's not right for our kids. It's not right for any children in Oregon. And what can happen, like statewide, as well as within a district, is we can perseverate on the problem, or we can finally decide we need to take some actions to solve the problem, to find solutions for our kids. So we looked at the research, the research that we looked at told us that lots of kids are coming to school like we were experiencing in our own community, not ready to be successful, to learn. They didn't know letters, they didn't know sounds, they didn't know numbers, things of that nature. They didn't know how to work in groups. They didn't know how to even do those school behaviors you would hope, like walk in a line or go to the lunchroom and be able to participate in some of those activities. We found that students who came behind typically stayed behind in spite of many of our efforts to provide remediation. And so we began partnering with various people within our community to try to find better ways to get to students before they come to us at grade K, as well as creating some of our own interventions or solutions to help students be successful by the time they come here. So there's one organization in our community, they call themselves, yes, Yamhill Enrichment Society. And the Yamhill Enrichment Society makes it their business to purchase a book. And a book is delivered upon delivery of a baby at our local hospital as soon as the child is born, encouraging the parent to read to the child early on. We implemented a program called Ready for Kindergarten. And our Ready for Kindergarten program is taught by volunteers. And those volunteers don't receive pay for providing lessons to parents of pregnant moms, parents of 1-year-old, 2-year-old, 3-year-old, 4-year-old children. And we give them some literacy skills to do with their kids at home, and see how those kids are prepared by the time they come to us in grade K. We get huge turnout, and it's a very positive program for very little cost, just the cost of kits, materials that we send parents off when they leave us. What's really important to know is when the Ready for Kindergarten assessment began in the state, was it 3 years now? 3 years we've been doing that? It's an assessment that's conducted for kindergarten students approximately the second week of school. Simple letter identification, sound identification. The first year we provided the assessment, McMinnville School District students knew 4 letters. So if you think about your own children or your grandchildren, you know, you sing ABCs in the car, whatever that might be, you might think they would come to school with more than that. And our kids, on average, were recognizing 4 letters. In our Ready for Kindergarten program, when we disaggregate the data, we find that the children of parents who participate in that program, on average, are recognizing 23 letters. Mm-hmm. So a real simple solution to a problem we are facing, that we're really getting some robust implementation going on in our district, and we think that will really change outcomes for kids coming to us. We partner, and actually we can move it to the next slide if you would. We partner with our local community care organization, or our CCO, and they have worked with us to provide funding for transition camps. So transition camps happen for our kinder students a couple weeks before the school year begins. And I want you to know that after we provided the kinder camp, the first thing that happened is parents came to me thanking me for the camp, because they now felt they wouldn't be crying when they let their little 5-year-old go to school that first day. So it really did a lot to help prepare the parents for kindergarten, and so that they know that their children would be safe in that process. But also, we do some learning activities with those students, and what's fundamentally important here, I think, is that the funding for that is being partnered with our local CCO. In addition to that, we do a Wellness to Learn. We've piloted a Wellness to Learn project, and the Wellness to Learn project is also in partnership with our community care organization. Across the board, with our K through 5 students, we have great difficulty in a poverty environment for students to get the kind of medical care they need, or the kind of care they need that allows them to be ready to learn. So, for example, students who need eyeglasses to read, we might be able to, through our vision screenings, refer a parent to take their child for an eye test and glasses, but they might not ever make it from the point of referral to actually the doctor. So we asked our CCO to help partner and actually give us a staff person who can walk that parent all the way from the referral that we make at the district into actually seeing a medical provider. So partnering up with a medical provider is really important. And I mention that because some of these, when we look at this from a community investment in our youngest children, I think that medical personnel, medical providers can very much help with this, along with the K-12 entity for all of its children. Always have concerns, biennium to biennium, for K-12 funding, as you know, and what superintendent would be worth their salt if they weren't here saying, we need more funds for K-12. So let's make sure you know we need more funds for K-12. With that, however, I would suggest that the districts need to know that they have the flexibility and the support from our state leaders to provide interventions for students at younger than grade 5, age 5, that they should be able to provide interventions either in partnership or solely to work with students who are 4-year-old or 5-year-old based upon their need. So if I got to wave my magic wand, and if I were able to suggest some things that could happen on behalf of all children in Oregon, I would recommend that we look at a minimum of all 4-year-olds having a preschool opportunity. And that can happen at the service of K-12. That can happen through private preschool providers. And if parents feel that they can provide those learning opportunities for their children at home, more power to them. They should be given that opportunity. But what we're doing in McMinnville is we began a 4-year-old program for parents whose children would benefit from a 4-year-old program, who don't otherwise have a preschool or even a daycare provider, and who don't have the luxury of providing some of those learning opportunities or field trip opportunities for their own children in their own home. So we would like to be able to expand that. We have 6 sections of 4-year-old programs that we're trying to help students bridge that gap, preschool programs, so that they come, again, better ready to learn and be able to succeed and access all the content that they can within our school district. So I guess the last thing I will mention is, and I, again, can address questions you have about specific programs or examples, is when I talk about K-12 funding, once upon a time, we were able to provide summer school for all of our children in elementary school. Those funds have long gone. And so when you hear things like extended day or extended school year, those are really important, because some children benefit by just having more time with quality instruction, especially if they're starting from behind. We've had to reduce what we're able to offer in terms of summer school opportunities, focusing on students ending their second grade year, going into their third grade year. And this group is talking to you about pre-K through grade 3, so I think it's important for you to hear that example. And so we bring all of our second graders in during the summer months, and we continue to work on their literacy, math literacy, and language arts literacy skills. So that they're prepared to be reading by the end of their third grade year. We've had lots of successes with these kinds of programs, in part because of our partnerships, and in part because we've just said we can't wait for someone else to do it, we need to do it. But I would really hope that our legislative leaders can help find ways to make sure that it's not if you're living in a lucky geographic area of the state, but that every geographic area is able to fully provide early learning opportunities for their students all the way up through grade 3, in some using some of the examples we've provided, and of course many that either I could talk about or other superintendents could talk about. So if you have questions, I'll be in the peanut gallery or
so. I have a couple questions before you leave. So you're to be commended first on the partnerships you've built to be able to provide them. I mean, that's a great example of putting together a lot of things. But I have a question. So you have half-day preschool, so I assume the school provides that?
Yes, that's correct.
And so you have paid instructors?
Yes, we do.
So you're committing resources to do that?
We are.
And so how do you outreach? So I'm trying to understand, given the, I don't know how many students we're talking about, but how do you outreach to try to make sure those, the underserved, that they indeed you get them involved in your
Because we're publicly funded, we are a first-come, first-serve basis in any of the limited programs that we might have to offer. But we work very closely with our Head Start providers.
Okay.
And with our Head Start providers, I mean, we have transition meetings. I have staff that sit on the Head Start board in our local county area and so on. We make sure that those families know this is something that's coming up. If you're interested, be sure to sign up for that program. And we tend to receive very much a large percentage of that population. And the reason for that is because of our local Head Start providers also, they'd like to be able to concentrate their funds age 3 and lower. Mm-hmm. And if I can offset and take more kids 4-year-old, that gives them more capacity to do with their grades 3 and under.
Sure. Great. Other questions? Representative Bynum.
Thank you so much for the presentation. I had a question about the Ready for Kindergarten program. The way it was implemented in our school district was, I think you got a note, this is the introduction to kindergarten, you got a note that the first week of school was not a real week of school. So, i.e., to a parent, that means, uh-oh, I have no child care. And we're going to test your kid, and this is the day that we're going to test your kid, which was really disruptive to me. And so I was wondering how you got to the Ready for Kindergarten, and if that first week of the official school year is a full week like a normal parent would expect.
Yes, long, long time ago in McMinnville School District, something similar to what you described occurred, and that really didn't make any sense to me, because if we only have 174 days of school, we really want all 174 days to count for all of our students. Mm-hmm. So if we were going to do anything like that, we knew from the onset that we would back it up and kids would get more time in order for those kinds of activities or assessments to occur. But really, an assessment isn't teaching. An assessment isn't causing change to occur with the skill set or the knowledge that the kids come in with and where we need to take them. So, excuse me. So years ago, I learned about a program, and I'm not even going to quote it correctly, and it was something like, it was done in East Coast, Kindergarten College. Some of you have probably heard about that before. And that really was the place we started. We wanted to do this, replicate this program, and I think it might have even been Pedro Naguara who started that way back when. That's what we really wanted to do and didn't have the funds or resources. So what was the next best thing? We were able to find this curriculum and this content Ready for K. We also didn't have any money to pay people to do it, but we thought it was so important we would roll it out and say, is there anyone who would like to help us present this information to parents? If we get the parents there, are there people who would like? And I'll tell you what. Daycare providers, kindergarten teachers, first grade, they thought it was so important they all jumped on board. They said, we'll go through the training, we'll learn it, we'll provide the instruction. So then it really became a matter for us of, you know, how do we get people there? Well, we'll serve a meal. How do we keep them there? We'll provide daycare for their children. And then what do we want them to leave with these learning kits for their students, which costs us anywhere from about $30,000 to $35,000 a year. So we wrote grants to get those kits in for the parents. So we have had such success with the outcomes of the program that those that provided us the grants continue to provide us the grants. So we're really running that program almost on zero district dollars short of food, and as I say food, I'm kind of laughing now because really we're not even having to bear that burden right now because we've qualified for CEP, Community Eligibility Program, provided by the federal government, and if you're at X amount of poverty, you can feed children for free. So just for the parent portion, we have to pick up that cost. So, and then the transition camps are not assessment camps. We make sure that we're providing instructional activities for the children in that setting too. Really important to get as much time as we can, and those are some ways we go about it.
And then the second part that I was wondering about, when they were doing the assessments, I don't think as a parent I ever found out where my kid ended up. And so I don't know what they decided. Is there a feedback mechanism for a parent? Because my assumption in some cases is there's another kid behind in the family structure that, you know, maybe as a parent I could do something better so that, you know, my next child comes prepared. But is there a feedback mechanism
there,
for these?
There are actually individual scores on each of these that you can see. And if that's something you'd like to know, I'd recommend you talk with that your child's kindergarten teacher, because
we thank God we got out of kindergarten.
Okay.
But, four times.
Yeah.
But
the same kid.
No.
Yeah.
Really.
Okay. Just
it was looking like that though. No, but I mean, just is that a standard where a parent gets the feedback? Because right now, like, we have the SBAC tests. We, as parents, did not get those back in some sort of reasonable range. And so my point is we're doing testing, but the parents either don't get the information back or we don't know what to do with it when we get it.
Let me make some comments specific to us, and then if Kara or Lindsay want to chime in, certainly they can do so. First of all, SBAC has been a little problematic in terms of getting the information back timely. It has improved. The first year it was implemented, we didn't receive the information until the following fall. So we sent the results home, but it made it difficult, I think, for families, because typically you'd prefer the teacher that you had when the test was being taken by the child to give the feedback to that parent. But we did send out the information. It just wasn't timely. But now we can get that information in the fall, so that is absolutely improving. In terms of how our students are doing on the kindergarten readiness, we're sharing that information with our parents at conferences. I'm not sure what is happening in other districts, whether something's being sent home or not, but we're trying to walk the parents through it, because with that we can say, and here's some things you might want to try to help Susie or help Johnny improve in this particular area.
Thank you.
Sure. Representative Malmstrom.
Thank you, Chair Lively. Quick question about the library books. Tell me a little more detail about that. Was that like through Healthy Families? Was it through the libraries? How did that come to be?
Well, I'll talk to you about two pieces. The first is the one that you receive in the hospital.
Right, that's what I was referring to.
And that actually, it initiated with a group of young moms who felt they could do so much more to help students in the community. And then they partnered with a group who was looking for a cause in their fundraising effort. And this became the cause. And so they began hosting fundraising events, and people came together to say this was important, and let's start putting money towards this. It's actually grown to where I think some of you may be familiar with the Dolly Parton literacy program.
Yeah.
So you pay X amount to Dolly Parton, and she'll send a book to everybody up till the age of kindergarten. So this is this group also now is funding that program in the community, and so parents who sign up can have these free books mailed from the, I'm not using the right name, but it's Dolly Parton's Literacy program, which is kind of neat as well. So that it began in part just through a very energized group of moms who wanted to make a difference in our county. But we also have local service clubs who are really committed to our pre-K programs, and so, for example, our Rotary Club. Guest speakers come to Rotary, and I know many of you are either Rotarians or have been to a Rotary meeting, and Rotary and other service clubs usually try to give someone who speaks a token, a pen, a Rotary bag, something like that. Our clubs sometimes will do those other items, tokens, but every speaker signs a book, and that book is an early learning pre-K to grade 3 book. It's a signature from them, and it goes into our local school libraries, and we have other things like our Rotarian and other service clubs donating a huge amount of literacy materials to our schools throughout the county. So it's a real commitment on the part of many people in our community to help students be prepared to learn.
Thanks.
So we actually have, we on our list of things to potentially talk about later is the Imagination Library, which is what she was describing, because some other communities are doing it, but a lot of communities don't know about it or are unable to, but that was a great example. So we have that later. We'll talk more in one of our other sessions about that and how that fits with early learning and all the other efforts, because having books in children's hands is very important. Mm-hmm. Other questions? Representative Kenny Geyer?
Hi, thank you. Thank you for the presentation from everyone. I'm curious about ratios. Several of us on this committee are looking at the discrepancy between child care ratio and then all of a sudden throwing kids into kindergarten. And I believe the child care ratio is 1 to 15, even when they're 5 years old. And so I don't know if there's a prescribed ratio for pre-K, for pre-K schools. So if you qualify as a child care, it's 15 to 1. And I'm just curious about, as you have talked about the transition from pre-K or child care or home care into kindergarten, where all of a sudden you might be in a class of 30 to 1, you know, different languages, different levels of kids who have come in from a socialized setting or, straight out of the home. Where your conversations have been about that piece of the transition.
I'm happy to deal with it. I don't know who you're directing the question to. But
actually, anyone? Anyone?
Can I start? You have a... Okay. So I'll start because I have the mic, see? Lindsay knows that. Once I lose the mic, it's... let me speak for a little bit of McMinnville and then some general comments, and then others can certainly, as I said before, chime in. But I just love the microphone. So let's go with that. First of all, if you take a look at the research on improving academic outcomes for students and class size, so class size typically done K through 12. Mm-hmm. The numbers generally talk about a class size level of 17 or below as really making a change. Economically, in Oregon, we've not been able to have the luxury of funding class sizes at the 17 or lower ratio. And so what is the next best thing? The next best thing is to ensure that you really have talented teachers in the classroom in front of children and to make sure you're spending a lot of time on quality professional development so that the very best teachers are providing the best instruction to students. The third thing would be making sure students have adequate time to learn. And the recipe of a 5.5 hour or 6 hour school day is not the same recipe that's required by every child. And so I cannot say enough how critical it is to have extended learning opportunities for students before or after school, and to have extended year opportunities for students. As I said before, 174 days may be enough for many. It certainly is not enough for all. And so if we're really after trying to leverage learning outcomes for kids, let's think how we can get them more time in a classroom in front of talented teachers. Now, that's not to say that we don't try to make sure that the lowest class sizes are at the youngest levels and the higher class sizes are at the upper grade levels. So right now we have a 28.5 ratio at the high school, 28.5 students to one teacher at the high school. At the elementary schools, we have a 24 ratio to one. At grades 3 through 5, we have a, if I can remember it, I think it's 22 or 21.5 ratio at grades 1 through 3, and yet again lower, 20 to 1 ratio at grade kinder for us, because that's what we can afford. However, two bienniums ago, we had a ratio of kindergarten 17 to 1 because we had better state funding that allowed us to prioritize that lower ratio, and we want to be in line with the research of 17 to 1. Lastly, I would say, though, I think it's really important, as much as many would advocate for putting caps on the ratio of 15 to 1, 16 to 1, 17 to 1, whatever that might be, it's even more important to get the students there and to get them in front of that quality instruction. So if the state cannot fund a 15 to 1 four-year-old program or a 10 to 1 four-year-old program, surely it can fund, you know, a 20 or a 25 ratio. Now, right now in our pre-Ks, in our four-year-old programs, we limit it to 16 to 1 because we don't have additional assistance in those programs. If we added additional assistance, then, of course, we might let those numbers grow.
So 16 to 1 in your pre-K?
In our four-year-old program, yes. So that's what we have currently done, again, tying to that below 17. But I would say, what's more worrisome to me is that I still have a number of students within our district who would benefit by such a program, and that I really need to extend or expand the number of seats that are available.
Would you like to say anything about that?
Yeah, I would just add that the conversation around ratios is an important one, and definitely agree with everything that Mary Alice said. I would also add that very often the research around ratios is also in the context of highly qualified teachers, that we have high-quality learning environments. So it's usually encompassed with other indicators of quality that make that a really impactful, you know, usually if we look at the research around ratios, that's just looking at ratios. That in and of itself doesn't tend to be the tipping point, but those low ratios that are accompanied by the high-quality environments, the high-quality teaching staff, those kinds of things really do make an impact.
So just follow up.
Sure, go ahead.
So, and the reason I'm asking for it is I am aware of the research, but I know that as you try to align the different systems and the child care division now comes under the early learning division, we have certain ratios in one set of regulatory framework, the child care, 15-1, and then under Department of Education, if you fall on that side of the line, and preschools, you've got a 16-1 for four-year-olds, whereas it has to be 15-1 for five-year-olds in a child care. So just trying to align these different systems and what's the rationale behind it, because even in the child care, sometimes the providers are not as highly educated as they are to become a qualified preschool teacher or kindergarten teacher under a system.
So I wouldn't propose that I comment on what's happening in the private industry or those rules relative to that, but I would like you to consider this, that when a K-12 system considers incorporating or reaching out to that younger population, mm-hmm. whether they be four-year-old children or younger, what the K-12 system does have is a lot of other capacity. So, for example, already I have in place school psychologists. Already I have in place school mm-hmm. nurses. Already I have in place counselors. Already I have in place opportunities for physical education, health education. There's a whole bunch of resources that I have at my disposal to assist those younger learners that might may or may not be available in some other self-contained or privatized entity. So I do think there needs to be flexibility at the K-12 level when they embrace taking on that younger population, because they're not going to staff it at a level they don't feel they're going to be successful at. So I just would encourage you to be thinking about it from that perspective, mm-hmm. if you could.
Okay. Other questions?
Thank
you. Oh, sorry.
Just, if I may, Mr. Chair, I think one of the things that I think is really to your question, and I think to Representative Bynum, your experience, I think one of the things that's most important about what's beginning to coalesce here in this work, whether that's at the state level or if it's in communities across the state, is I think there's a really robust conversation that we're having about what are the effective practices and strategies that we need. And I think there are probably steps that we can take as a state. You know, I look at the work you just talked about in terms of transitional supports mm-hmm. for children and families as they're making that shift. There may be some resources we should be investing in that, but short of it, there's also the opportunity for school districts to be making those investments themselves, just as you've done in McMinnville. So I think that's an important part of this, is that some of it comes down to how we're allocating resources in the most effective way. So.
So I have another question with your kindergarten transition program. I know we've tried this in Portland Public Schools as well. Are you able to do these in each of your kindergarten, your K-5 schools, or do you have to combine, like, three different schools will share one setting?
No, we do it at all the schools.
Every school has
every
it.
School.
That's great.
For all of our family members. And the only thing that will be unique this coming fall is we're doing a lot of construction over the summer months. Mm. And if we do have a plan B, that if certain buildings aren't ready to be open to receive, that we'll pair up some of those activities. But that is not our preference. Our preference is to always do it in the homeschool. And to date, we have done that.
That's fantastic. Can I ask one other question? Since we have a superintendent here, it's great to ask. And the committee's going to laugh because I often ask about dental needs with my colleague here.
That's right.
So we just had the rollout of the dental screening. You talked about vision screening, and I just am curious about how that may have gone in your district.
So I will begin by saying to you that I still have the luxury of shaking the hands of every graduate that crosses our stage in McMinnville. And I do that for lots of reasons. And one of the reasons I do that is to see what work we have yet to do. And one of the things I've been very concerned about and been talking about for a number of years in our community is these children come across this stage so thrilled. They are so excited. This is this wonderful opportunity, and they are filled with hopes and dreams. And the superintendent, who they know the least, gets a big hug, and they're smiling. And my 17 and 18-year-olds have a huge amount of dental decay. Mm-hmm. And that just isn't right for any child by the time they reach 17 or 18 to have that at issue. Mm-hmm. So I think the dental screening is critical and important, and the rollout went fine for us, but that's not enough. Okay. For the same reason that I spoke earlier about some parents having trouble getting their children from the vision screening to actually getting the glasses, that same thing exists in communities, certainly, of poverty, getting them from that dental screening to mm-hmm. having the decay corrected. Mm-hmm. It should not be that way for any of our children, particularly when we have the kinds of revenue available to us to support these medical and dental concerns for our kids. So, since you opened up that little trap in the door.
Go for it.
What I would like to say is I think as those of us from K-12 are concerned about not just how we're going to be providing the instructional tools for kids to learn, I think we remain concerned that there are not enough revenues that could be moved from healthcare to K-12. Now, some people are already mad at me for even suggesting that idea. But as I said earlier, we have nurses in schools. We have occupational therapists and physical therapists. We have people who provide speech services. There is no reason we shouldn't be having medical providers that are funded through the Oregon Health Plan or CCOs that actually are in our schools. Now, you might think about how some entities already have clinics in their schools. Mm-hmm. And you might know that some of those maybe are fully funded through those healthcare providers, and I don't know. I know in my situation, people want me to pay part of that, to pay half of a salary here, half of a salary there, half a salary there. Really, what we should be concerned with is the health of all of our children, whether it be medical or dental. And there's no reason that those countywide services who are charged with providing this assistance to those who can't otherwise provide it can't be doing it within our school. So I would ask for more. I would say it's working well, but our children really deserve to walk across that stage with a full set of teeth in their heads at the early ages of 17 and 18.
Great. Thank you very much. Any other questions? No, thank you. We really appreciate you taking the time. That was great.
Chair Lively, good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Brett Walker. I am the P3 Alignment Specialist with the Early Learning Division, and this afternoon I'm going to be sharing some information with you about a program called the Early Learning Kindergarten Readiness Partnership and Innovation Program, which is a bit of a mouthful, so I'll be referring to it as Partnership and Innovation from here on out. This is, for all intents and purposes, our state investment in P3 work in communities throughout our state. Partnership and Innovation has three primary goals, the first of which is improving children's readiness for kindergarten, and as part of our broader efforts of closing early opportunity gaps and ensuring children are arriving in school ready to succeed. The second is really focused around building local pre-K through 3 systems that create seamless experiences for children, families, and educators. And the third is about identifying models for P3 work at the local level that can be scaled and replicated. So a lot of what we do with this is try to learn about what's happening and share the good ideas, share the success stories. This work is taking place all over Oregon. The funds for this program flow through our 16 early learning hubs. I do want to emphasize that although the funds flow through the early learning hubs, the work is really designed to be local work. So there is work through this program taking place in over 200 communities throughout our state. For the purposes of this program, I tend to think about communities as elementary school catchment areas. That's often the way the work gets defined by the early learning hubs and their local early learning and K-12 partners. Communities involved in this work range from our most urban to some of our most rural communities in every corner of the state. And the type of work that's being implemented looks really different from community to community as well. So in some cases, we have communities that are heavily invested in a very comprehensive pre-K through 3 approach or prenatal through 3 approach, and others that are more focusing on specific programs or initiatives around kindergarten transition, for example. And that differentiation by community is very much by design. There's a lot of local flexibility built into this model. We want the work taking place around the state to be responsive to local needs and local conditions. The work taking place under Partnership and Innovation focuses on 3 primary areas of that P3 framework that Kara shared with you. The first is around shared professional development for early learning providers and K-3 teachers. We say shared professional development, that's really a shorthand for more comprehensive shared professional collaboration. And in some cases, it does look like professional development, shared training opportunities. In others, it looks like providers of early learning services and early learning programs working very closely with elementary school teachers and administrators to develop and implement shared approaches to curriculum, instruction, classroom environment, classroom practice, assessment practices. And that's where we think the rubber really meets the road in a lot of ways for this work. Our other two priority areas are around family engagement and kindergarten transition. If we just to kind of give you a sense of what this work looks like in most communities around the state, I think we have many, many strong examples of effective family engagement and kindergarten transition practices in Oregon. I think there are fewer examples of the shared really strong and effective shared professional development around the state, although we do have some, and we are starting to see more and more communities wanting to invest their P3 efforts in this space. So that's something that's personally exciting to me. Just wanted to share a few examples of some of the promising practices that we're starting to see. This is just a really scratching the surface here. And I'm not going to get into detail here, but I did want to share a few things from just different corners of the state and highlight a few themes. One is that we are seeing promising practices and models that we think can be scaled up in each of the 3 priority areas that I just mentioned. Second, we're seeing many communities around the state focusing their efforts around building capacity of adults, whether those be parents and caregivers, or whether they be early learning providers and K-3 teachers, on children's social-emotional development, which we know is an absolutely critical aspect of children's readiness for kindergarten. And third, we are actually, in many cases, seeing some scaling already taking place and replication taking place both within early learning hubs and across early learning hub regions. And I think the Ready for K program that you heard about a few minutes ago is one example of that. So we think we have a lot of promising work happening around the state. I want to share just a few data points here. What you're looking at right now is survey data that's been collected through a program evaluation process that we partner with Portland State University on. And this data is self-report survey data from parents and caregivers describing differences in specific attitudes, behaviors, and beliefs that are associated with supporting children to be ready for school. And what you're looking at is essentially a before and after parent self-report after parents have participated in some type of ongoing family engagement or kindergarten transition activity. And what you can see is that pretty much across the board, after participating in these ongoing activities, and again, they look very different from community to community, but after participating in them, parents are reporting back to us that they feel a much stronger sense of being able to support their child's learning at home and being able to support their readiness for kindergarten. And we know that this type of parent self-efficacy and caregiver self-efficacy is actually really important for children as they transition into school. It's one of the things that I look at this work and I'm actually most excited about when I look at the data. Similarly, we're looking here at data from early learning providers on the bottom, K-3 teachers on the top who have participated in some of the shared ongoing professional development activities. And basically what you're seeing here is the extent to which they agree with the statement on the left-hand side, both before and after having participated in the program. On the top, what this is showing us is that the K-3 teachers that have been able to participate in this type of work have a better sense of what's happening in early learning programs and the types of early learning experiences that children have. And on the bottom, what we're seeing is early learning providers letting us know that they have a much better sense of what kindergarten teachers are expecting of children when they're coming into the kindergarten classroom. May not seem like much. This is really foundational for the type of more in-depth and ongoing and comprehensive shared professional collaboration that we're trying to foster. So again, this is data that I look at and get excited about. So, and with that, if there are no questions, I'll go ahead and hand it over to Lisa. But happy to take any questions that anyone has.
Okay.
All right. Chair Lively, for the record, my name is Lisa Harnish, and I'm the Executive Director of the Marin and Polk Early Learning Hub, and it is my pleasure to be here with you today to talk about some of the work that we are doing with, we call it Kindergarten Partnership and Innovation. We still have the kindergarten in there, so I may slip into acronym mode and call it KPI. So if I do, that's what I'm referring to. So we have been doing Kindergarten Partnership and Innovation, or KPI. This is our third year, and it really has become just a real part of the fabric and the foundation of the work that we are doing as a hub. And it is, as we all know, the early learning hubs are really charged with meeting these big three goals. I call them the big three in our hub region. The services are coordinated and aligned, that children are more ready for kindergarten, and that families are stable and attached. And Kindergarten Partnership and Innovation is really helping us to really propel in meeting those three overarching goals. Not only does KPI allow us to work with families earlier, prior to them entering into the K-12 world, it's allowing us the ability to bring together different programs or different structures to help support families. Also, connecting the professionals. When we think about the childcare, when we think about Head Start, Oregon pre-kindergarten, and our kindergarten teachers, bringing them together to help make sure that we're creating that seamless pathway for children and families. We have been focusing our work with Kindergarten Partnership and Innovation, or KPI, just as Brett mentioned, in catchment areas. And this, we have been utilizing the elementary school catchment areas as how we define where the work is happening, even though that we know that many families are not yet attached to a school. Sometimes they might be, but they may not yet be, which is, I think, also very important because it allows us to create that familiarity, that connection for families with schools prior to them even showing up at the doors, which has been very helpful for families as they have been doing that. It's also allowed us the ability to connect partners together. As I already mentioned, there are many of our school or even our Head Start or preschool programs had no no idea that each other existed, or even what would happen in a preschool program, or what would happen, or what the expectations were for kindergarten. Likewise, and probably even more so when you think about the child care. So bringing those systems together has had a tremendous impact and in our various communities. KPI as part of is really just is one, but probably the most foundational initiative that we have as a hub. We tie KPI, actually we work really hard to tie all of our initiatives together in some form or some fashion. KPI is very tied in with the work that we do with parent education, and it's also really been foundational in our supporting the increase in quality with our child care networks. This is Vroom is an app for families and helping to give them skills and tools. We've been tying that into the work that we have been doing. Also has been a way for us to connect families with resources that they might not otherwise be aware of through the family support funds. KPI has also been instrumental for us as a hub region for our ability to apply for and receive and implement Preschool Promise. And I was here before you probably a week ago or a week and a half ago talking about Preschool Promise. So KPI has really been one of those foundational things that has allowed us to bring the community together in a very real way. KPI, as Brett mentioned, is sort of that three-prong approach, making sure that we've got that vertically aligned professional development happening. It is also around engaging with families and also focusing on parent education. In our community, we have now 31 elementary catchment areas that are doing KPI, which has really been exponential. This last biennium, we have basically doubled our KPI size, which has been fabulous to see that spread across the community. For us to be able to identify where we are going to do our work, this is where we use data to help inform where we're putting our resources into the community. So we looked at the federal poverty level, of which our hub region has a very significant population. One of our schools has over 95% at the FPL level, and then all the way down to 25%. And so we have overall very high and significant free and reduced lunch population across our community. We also look at the kindergarten assessment scores, which, as you've already heard, we're now just finished the fourth year of assessment, and so we're starting to get some traction and see some trends with that. We also look at third grade reading, and then we also look at the diversity and the cultural makeup of our communities. And so it's there that we have selected now the 31 across Marion and Polk counties. Our dollars also help support KPI coordinators to help bring together all of the various partners. That's a very key and critical part, at least in our hub region, to be able to have a convener who can work with each of our catchment areas on identifying the plan, keeping all the partners apprised, and keeping the real movement forward. And that has been instrumental. In fact, we have our schools and our teachers who have really seen significant value in having that help and to augment that. Our school professionals are very tapped, and they aren't able always to, even though they're clearly invested, having that extra support has been very critical. One piece that we have been very strident on with our catchment areas who are working with us on KPI is including parent education as a part of this work. And what we learned from the Department of the Early Learning Division and also Portland State University and looking at the survey, it's, and to borrow a term from the medical profession, dosage really matters. You know, I think the first year we were kind of okay with having some, I called them one-hit wonders, you know, the math nights, the literacy nights in schools. Those are great, but that's not where we're really going to see the movement that we're wanting to see with KPI. And so that's where we have been able to braid and blend and funding to be able to support parent education to happen in our sites. So we are working with communities to bring evidence-based curriculum such as abriendo puertas or opening doors, making a parenting a pleasure, nurturing parenting. We're bringing those into the communities, and families are really really embracing those opportunities. And the great thing about doing that is it allows us to connect with families earlier before they enter into the school realm. It also allows us to open up parent education to the school population as a whole, which has been fabulous for families. The other thing that we are weaving in as a part of what our communities may choose to do or to focus on is Ready for Kindergarten. We learned from our partners in Yamhill and McMinnville and wanted to get some of that Ready for Kindergarten in our community as well. And that has been, we are very new into it. We've been doing it for about a year, not quite a year, and that has had significant impact in our sites who are choosing to use Ready for Kindergarten. For one thing, it's one of those things that you as a parent, you're not only getting the tools and the skills on how to utilize those with your family. So parents walk away with the tools or toys and how to use them in their home with them. It's also something that, you know, over the course of time, they come for three times, which is a little bit less intensive. Some of the evidence-based curriculum is about a 10 or a 13-week series. And so that's a big chunk of time for families. It has also been a way for us to connect with our child care environment in a very real way. We are implementing Ready for K as part of our child care providers. We're doing training with our child care providers so that they can use this in their facilities with them. So it's again weaving together all of the various pieces. So I've already talked through really this next slide pretty much in its entirety. We have also, as part of the parent education, we have been working with the Oregon Community Foundation and have been weaving in dental education as well as a part of what we have been offering. It's about a 45-minute to an hour curriculum. It's also giving families different things to take home and do with their children, some other activities that they can do with their children, and promoting healthy dental habits, and that has been very helpful. Backing up to Ready for K, one story that somebody just told us actually this last week, we just held a Ready for Kindergarten session recently, and there are two new families who showed up for one of the sessions, and upon asking them how they'd heard about this, they'd actually heard about it at the bus stop from in their community, and so they showed up because somebody is telling them about it, which has been, I mean, again, just sort of seeing that people are really reaching out. It's also been a way for us to connect with families who are on waiting lists for Head Start or Oregon Pre-Kindergarten. So if they are on a waiting list, which we do have a significant waiting list for those programs as well as Preschool Promise, so letting families know there is Ready for Kindergarten training that is available to you, and so inviting families to come in. And so that's had a tremendous impact as well. So we are very excited about the KPI. Again, this has been something that's been foundational for our community. What we love about it, too, our communities love it because they get to design what is going to work for them based on the needs in their community, considering the demographics, some of the cultural implications, and really bringing the community together, both in terms of the professionals as well as with the families as well. So we're excited to be a part of it. And I'd be happy to take any questions.
So I have a question regarding the 31. So is 31 it, or are there other catchment areas or elementary districts where there could be, where you could provide programs?
Absolutely. So we have actually 75 catchment areas. Right. And we have 14 school districts. We're currently in 7 of our school districts.
Oh, okay.
So we have room
Lots
to grow.
Lots of opportunity.
Room to grow.
And I have a question. So we hear a lot about poverty in particular. In fact, we hear too much about it, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But I'm trying to understand, because in all the school districts, and I hear it in my school district, the free and reduced lunch and the criteria, and there's some dispute among those about how that is actually reached. So who qualifies? So if a school is 90%, who qualifies for free and reduced lunch, and how do you determine that? Or does everybody in the school qualify? So I'm just trying to understand where that fits in all of this and how we measure it.
I don't know that I can speak to the specifics on that. So I don't know that I'm qualified to do that. But so I'll leave it there, but I'd happy to.
To be perfectly honest, I'm not sure that I can directly answer the question as well, but we could certainly do some follow-up for you on that one. What I will say is that in terms of where early learning hubs and their partner organizations choose to invest these resources locally, each early learning hub has a target population and a set of target communities that they're primarily focused on. And one of the benefits of having these funds flowing through the early learning hubs is that it allows folks like Lisa and her colleagues to be able to make some determinations around where can we get the most bang for buck with these dollars. So, and certainly poverty, you know, plays a significant role in making those determinations.
Superintendent Russell, would that be something you'd be willing to respond to?
I can't.
Please. Do you have a question?
Yeah, well, I was going to say Superintendent Russell can correct
me. She's here. And
she can correct me if I'm wrong. I've heard back from superintendents that didn't like, when we started out the free and reduced lunch and the snacks and stuff, they didn't particularly care that those children were taken off to another room and kind of a light was shown on them because, and so they were different in some way. And so a lot of the school districts have, you know, brought the snacks and stuff into the room, and it's inclusive so that they wouldn't be segregating kids out.
Right. So free and reduced status. There's a federal, there are federally published guidelines. You know, a family of four who earns under X amount of dollars, and I'll misquote those today, but let's say it's $25,000 or something like that. And those numbers I have, and certainly can forward them on to you. But there's an X number. And if you're a family of four, and your parents make less than this amount, you qualify for either free lunch or reduced lunch. So reduced lunch, you're paying a portion of your meal. Free, your meal is totally free to you as an individual. And then schools have been rated this in terms of poverty based on the percent of students that are free and reduced. So a 90% might mean that 90 of 100 students in that particular school either qualify for a free or a reduced meal.
Can I just interact real quick?
Sure.
You want to make sure, Chair Lively, that you also talked about the bill we just passed last long session that actually Oregon doesn't even, on House Ed, we passed a bill that Oregon actually doesn't even have a reduced lunch really anymore. If you're on reduced lunch, kids get free lunch.
Yes, and
so we really don't.
That's what I thought.
And there's another program which you heard me refer to, CEP, Community Eligibility Program, and that's based on what total percent of poverty a particular school is. So you could, let's say you could have 90% of your students who would otherwise qualify under a earnings for the parent, but because it's 90% or more, the whole school then would get their meals free, even those parents, children of parents who might be above that income level. And so I say that to you only because there, you know, there will always be rewrites of those nutrition laws at the federal level, and we strongly would encourage Oregon to support continuation of CEP programs for the benefit of all of our students. And if I may, you know, we mentioned this notion of poverty and making sure that programs are located in areas where there is poverty, and of course that makes sense because those children don't come to school with the same resources that other children do. You know, in other words, some kids may never get to OMSI before they come to school, while others might get all kinds of field trips, OMSI, Disneyland, you name it, and that helps broaden their world. But I guess I would just mention that, you know, in Oregon, anyone who wants to go to first grade can. Anybody who wants to go to fifth grade can. And I really think we need to be thinking about that anyone who needs some early learning opportunities can get them in Oregon. And it shouldn't be relegated, you know, to only one geography or only those places we can afford. And I think as a state we could do so much more to just say any child age four who is in need of a quality preschool gets it one way or another, whether it's a private pay, as some parents choose, private first grade, private fifth grade, or there's a public source for that. And I would just advocate that you consider that through your various leadership roles. It's critically important to us in our state at this time. I would liken the needs we have for our children to that old metaphor of trying to fix the plane while you're flying it. You know, my five-year-olds are only going to be five-year-olds this year. They need all the resources we can give them. The four-year-olds in the state of Oregon today are only four-year-olds this year. They need all the resources we can give them. And I only mention this because I've been doing this work for more than 35 years. And it's never the right time in Oregon. There's never enough money in Oregon. There's never this, there's never that. And really, we have to say the time has to be right now. We must find collectively creative ways to provide the services to our children at the youngest possible ages.
Any other questions? Representative Kinney-Geyer.
Thank you. I couldn't agree more with all the things that you're saying. you had a slide up a couple ago that talked about family supports, the other half of our committee name here, and housing was one of them listed. And I'm wondering to what degree is housing a real challenge in Marion and Polk counties, and how are you able to use resources to help families with that?
That's a great question.
If you are able to use family.
Yeah. So Chair Lovely and Representative Kinney-Geyer, that's a great question. I would say we're just not even barely scratching the surface. We do have family support funds that are meant for emergent situations. And so we work within our catchment areas to help meet emergent needs that families may have. And oftentimes it is supports for rental assistance if they've been evicted or on the process of being evicted and some supports in that way. But it's not as big as the housing chasm really is in our community. So we recognize that it is a big implication or a big issue that we have. We have been working with some other organizations such as Fostering Hope or other housing to really help early learning be a part of what they offer. So I've been part of some of those strategic conversations and helping to connect and make sure that parent education is a part of some of that. But so I'd say we're just on the tip of the iceberg there.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Representative Bynum, please.
And it could be for the panel as well as our earlier panel. One of the things that came to mind when we had this last weather event in January was the interruption in education delivery for our students. And what happened at my house was that one kid had distance learning at the high school level, another at the first grade level. His teacher sent some online resources, but the two in the middle were left looking at me. And so I wanted to talk about are we thinking about ways to deliver learning opportunities into the home, especially when there are interruptions or during the summertime, if we can't bring the kids to the schools? What resources can parents utilize to have parents continue the education that the kids are getting at the schools?
Sure. From our perspective with our hub region, Preschool Promise would be an example. So Preschool Promise, they have to guarantee 900 hours of instruction for that. And so we've been working with our providers to see how are they going to meet that 900 hours. So some might be extending the days or making sure that it's built in that capacity. Ready for K, I think, or Ready for Kindergarten is a great tool and a great resource for families to be able to have some things when they are, you know, cooped up because of snow or whatever, that they can be able to use that. And I would say we're just sort of on the beginning threads of that. Also, as it relates to some of the parent education and also working with our medical community to help give them some ideas and different things that they can do to support their efforts around literacy. We have, as part of some of what we're doing with Reach Out and Read with our medical community, to make sure that they're talking about the joy of reading, and these are some things that you can do on a regular basis with your family. So,
yeah. I just thought what my high schooler was getting from, and she's attending a Catholic school, was wildly disproportionate to what the younger kids were getting at the public school. I mean, they didn't miss any school days. They had assignments. I mean, she was locked down in her room. She's like, I hope we don't miss a day of school this week because we have snow planned for Thursday and Friday, I think. And she said to me last night, I sure hope they don't cancel school because I do not want another, you know, I think they call it distance learning day or something like that. But what the younger kids got, or the middle kids actually, was nothing. And I felt like there was an opportunity for us to take a leap, especially in public education, to figuring out how to do learning when the kids are not at school, delivered online. So.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. Couldn't agree more.
Any other questions? Doesn't look like it. Thank you very much. Thank you to all of you that provided information today. So I'm going to close the informational hearing, and I'm going to open a work session to consider at least one bill for the committee introduction, and that is LC 2980, which relates to employment-related daycare. This bill is on OLIS, and the bill comes from Family Forward Action and Family Forward Oregon. It expands the types of activities eligible for subsidies, for example, types of casework and time spent looking for work, adjust co-payments to 10% of the subsidy. And when we had that presentation, we talked some about the percent of subsidy or not. Creates an optional training opportunities and provides enhanced reimbursement to child care providers who participate in training, incentivize parents who participate, and appropriates funds to expand. Now, we all understand the environment in which we're operating from the standpoint of the budget, but after looking at this potential one, I think it's important to get it on the calendar and have the conversations about it. We don't know where we'll end, but I think we all know that there's a need for more opportunities through this particular program, and so that's why I'm asking to be introduced to the committee bill.
Chair Lively, I move that the legislative concept 2980, dated 11/9/16, be introduced as a committee bill.
Represent Peluso moves that LC 2980, dated 11/9/16, be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Okay, hearing none, let's would you call the roll, please?
Representative Bynum.
Aye.
Representative Hayden.
Excused.
Representative Huffman.
Aye.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Aye.
Representative Malmstrom.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hack.
Aye.
Vice Chair Peluso.
Aye.
Chair Lively.
Aye. Motion carries. And we don't have any other committee bills at this time. We're running out of time to present, so I keep encouraging people, if there are things of that you have, we can get them introduced and onto the docket so we can at least discussion. So I'll close the workstation. And so one other item, committee. So we've been sitting here for quite a few days, taking a lot of information in, and I believe having good conversations. But what I want to do is kind of call a timeout on March 2nd and have an opportunity for us to discuss. So talk some about what we've heard, what we think what we've see is the progress being made. We can talk some about, we've been presented information about how they're measuring that, but get a sense of where we're at. We'll talk about some of what we have scheduled in the future and see if that covers where we're at. But then you see what your questions and things are, so we make sure we get those covered. We're rapidly coming to a point where we're going to have very important budget discussions. And since I serve on the education sub, I want to be as aligned as I can with what we're doing, this work we're doing here, and that to make sure I represent all of you when we're having those conversations. And so while this is not normal, it's a struggle. But I've spoke with the speaker and people, so they said we can take time. Some of you know I don't. This process sometimes leaves me. We just don't have enough chance to talk from what we've heard, and we're just filling a lot of information. So we're planning to spend all or part of the time on March 2nd. So bring your questions. Let's put our ideas out there. We have other questions and things. Maybe some things long-term, maybe suggested policy things we want to move towards. But we need to put all that out there and then see what other gaps we have. Mm-hmm. So does that work for people?
Yeah.
Okay. You don't have a choice. I'm the chair. I'm going to do it anyway. But anything else to come before the committee?
You just want to appear agreeable.
That's right. Okay, if not, we'll adjourn. Okay, if not, we'll adjourn.